Okay, we're in 1 Kings chapter 9. 1 Kings chapter 9. Solomon is king and takes him 20 years and he builds the temple. He builds his own house, builds a palace for himself. Takes him 20 years and we pick it up 20 years into his reign. Chapter 9, verse 1. And it came to pass, when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all Solomon's desire which he wanted to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon the second time, as he had appeared to him in Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built to put my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. Now, we saw back in, well, I forgot what chapter it was, 6 or so, where God appears to Solomon after he makes this big sacrifice at Gibeon. And it was in a dream. So maybe perhaps this is where this happens, where God speaks to him in a dream and God says, I've heard your prayer. We saw in the last chapter Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple and how he was saying, God, would you honor this place? When people pray at this place, when they're in a far distant land and they're praying towards this place, would you hear their prayers? And so God's saying, yes, of course, I'm going to honor this place. I'm going to hear their prayers. Verse 4, now if you walk before me as your father David walked in the integrity and in uprightness, in integrity of heart and in uprightness to do according to all that I have commanded you, and if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. Now, God says to Solomon, you do what's right, and I'll honor you. We'll have a Davidic reign. The house of David will reign forever. And this kind of sounds like you do good, you get rewarded. And that's what it is. That's because actually, my friends, God works that way. We sometimes look at the concept of rewards as being an Old Testament thing. That if you obey, God will bless. But my friends, it's a whole Bible concept. God rewards obedience. Life works better when you do the right things. It does. It doesn't work painless. Doesn't mean there's no pain when you do the right things. But life works better when you do the right things. Jesus said in John 14:23, look for the reward. Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. That kind of sounds like he's saying, if you love me, and if you do what I'm asking you to do, he says, you're going to experience God's love. You're going to experience God's presence in a new way. And that's not even just in the future, like when you get to heaven, then you get goodies. But God rewards good behavior. Sometimes we get this silly idea that rewards are not a good thing and that Christians shouldn't be living for the rewards. My friends, that's Jesus talks about rewards all the time. There's nothing wrong with doing the right thing and then watching God reward you. Not everybody likes rewards though.
The Capital One Cash Rewards card gives you a 50% annual bonus, and everyone but her likes 50% more cash. But I have an idea.
Do you want a princess dress?
Yeah.
How about some cupcakes?
Yeah.
Lollipop?
Yeah.
Do you want an Etch-a-Sketch?
Yeah.
Do you want 50% more cash?
No.
You got talent.
The Capital One Cash Rewards Card. With a 50% annual cash bonus, it's the card for people who like more cash.
But you want it.
I usually say that.
Rewards are not a bad thing, my friends. Things go better in your life when you do the right thing. June 6th, 1981, Doug White and his bride Sylvia were escorted to their hotel's fancy bridal suite in the wee hours of the morning. In the suite, they saw a sofa, chairs, and table, but where was the bed? Then they discovered that the sofa was a hide-a-bed with a lumpy mattress and sagging springs. They were not real happy. They spent a fitful night, woke up in the morning with sore backs. The new husband went to the hotel desk in the morning and gave the management a tongue-lashing. The clerk said, "Well, did you open the door in the room?" And Doug went back into the room, and he opened the door that they thought was a closet. And there inside was a fruit basket, chocolates, and a jacuzzi, and a huge bed. Opening the doors in the honeymoon suite is like obeying. It's like doing the right thing. And God rewards it. God rewards us when we're doing the right thing. It doesn't mean that life's going to be happy. It doesn't mean there's no problems. Because life is filled with problems, isn't it? But gang, it is so much better when you do the right things than when you do the wrong things, right? You know what it's like. You know, you don't get rewards for doing the wrong things, do you? You get life's pain and stuff. It's okay. God rewards. Verse 6. But if you or your sons at all turn from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them. And this house which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. Israel will become a proverb and a byword among the peoples. And as for this house which is exalted, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and will hiss and say, "Why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house?" Then they will answer, "Because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and have embraced other gods and worshipped them and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all this calamity on them." This is a warning. It's prophetic. And Solomon and his descendants would turn away from following the Lord. And the calamity didn't happen all at once. It would, my gosh, Solomon is somewhere after 1000 BC, but the calamity doesn't happen until 586 BC. So God's a little bit patient, and he gets them lots and lots of warnings, and more warnings, and more warnings, and more warnings. And one day, God would remove the people from the land. The temple would be removed. I don't know if you're reading along with us in our Through the Bible thing, but we're just started Lamentations this morning. And it's all about the weeping of the people over the destruction of the land. You know, it happened. It actually happened, just like God warned Solomon. You need to pay attention to God's warnings. And God doesn't give us warnings without a reason. And so when you sense that you're being warned, pay attention. Pay attention. He may not wait 400 years all the time. But pay attention to God's warnings. Verse 10. Now it happened at the end of 20 years, when Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house, Hiram the king of Tyre had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress and gold as much as he desired, that King Solomon then gave, so at the end of this 20 years, King Solomon then gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. Then Hiram went from Tyre to see the cities which Solomon had given him, but they did not please him. So he said, "What kind of cities are these which you have given me, my brother?" And he called them the land of Kabul, as they are this day. Then Hiram sent the king 120 talents of gold. Now this is a little bit confusing now. So it mentions about Hiram had supplied stuff to Solomon for the building of the temple. We saw this back in chapter 5. And when Hiram helped, Hiram the king of Tyre helped Solomon build the temple. But he didn't do it for free. Solomon, in 1 Kings 5:11, Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household, 20 cores of pressed oil that Solomon gave to Hiram year by year. So all along the way, Solomon's paying for this. This stuff didn't come for free. He's not now paying him back. Solomon has been paying him all along. That was their arrangement. They had this, you know, he gives them wheat and oil, and this guy gives us logs and stones and stuff. But now, at the end of 20 years, Solomon decides to give Hiram this gift, this 20 cities. 20 cities in the land of Galilee, up north. And Hiram goes out and looks at them, and he calls them Kabul, which means good for nothing. It kind of sounds like this was one of those kinds of gifts that he did not like. You know, like a fruitcake or something. That's what we might think. You know, it's kind of like this. You know, you get the fruitcakes for Christmas, and what do you do? I hope I didn't offend somebody, because it's probably somebody here gives fruitcakes for Christmas. We love fruitcakes for Christmas, don't we? But what if it really wasn't that bad of a gift? He gives them these cities up in the far north of Israel. And the far north of Israel is the prettiest part of Israel. It is. That's what's so crazy about it. The south is all desert. The north is all lush and green. And yet this guy goes out and looks at him and he goes, good for nothing. Good for nothing. I'm kind of baffled at this. The writer doesn't give us much commentary on it. But he doesn't go, wow, woohoo, what a great gift. Oh, Solomon, you're so great. He says, oh, it's good for nothing. I'm just amazed at that. I was thinking about the kinds of gifts that God gives us. And it's probably a good idea for us not to call God's gifts Kabul. You know, one of the words in the New Testament that you are familiar with that speaks of God's gifts is the word grace. Grace is when God gives us stuff that we don't deserve. And his gifts are wonderful. They're precious. It might be the gift of your spouse. Do you consider your spouse a gift or Kabul? Uh-oh. I might have nailed some people there. Sorry. They're not Kabul. They're important. They're a gift from God. You know, sometimes our kids drive us crazy, don't they? But gifts, that your children are a heritage. They're gifts from God. And it's hard because sometimes you just don't get it when they're driving you nuts. You know, when they're running around the house and making noise and making mess or whatever. But they are precious. They're God's treasures. It may be your job. Some of you are blessed with having a job. I know folks who are struggling, looking for a job. And I know that sometimes we look at our jobs and we, you know, and after a while we, you know, all we can think about is that crazy boss of mine or whatever, you know. But it is a treasure. It is a gift. It's a gift. So I guess we probably should be kind of careful about what we call Kabul. Good for nothing. Now it says in verse 14, it kind of makes it sounds kind of crazy because Solomon gives Hiram these 20 cities, and then Hiram sends the king 120 talents of gold. That's approximately 9,000 pounds of gold, somewhere around $225 million. Now, it almost makes it sound like he's given him payment for these cities. And maybe he's just, even though he's the king of the Phoenicians, because he's king, that's where Tyre is, the Phoenicians. And maybe he's just being a good Jewish businessman saying, oh, it's just worth nothing. It's really worth like $800 million, but I'm only going to give you $225. Maybe he's doing something like that. I don't know. Josephus, in his history books, he's the Jewish historian writing around 100 AD. He gives us an account that's not in the Bible, so we're not absolutely positively sure this is what happened, but he's quoting another ancient historian named Dius, who wrote this. Where'd it go? Wow, it disappeared. Huh. Well, I'll just read it to you. Okay. Solomon, who was then king of Jerusalem, sent riddles to Hiram and desired to receive the like from him, but that he could not solve them, but that he who could not solve them should pay money to them that did solve them, and that Hiram accepted the conditions. And when he was not able to solve the riddles proposed by Solomon, he paid a great deal of money for his fight. They have a bet going amongst each other. Who can come up with the most difficult riddle? And if you can't solve my riddle, you have to pay me money. And so it says he paid a great deal of money for his fine, but that afterwards he did solve the proposed riddles by means of a fellow named Abdamon, a man of Tyre, and that Hiram proposed other riddles, which when Solomon could not solve, he paid back a great deal of money to Hiram. So they had this bet going. You know, who can come up with the trickiest puzzles? Now, this was something that we'll see. This was something that ancient kings did because they had time on their hands or something. This is what they did instead of Facebook. They would do these kind of things. They'd send these puzzles back and forth. And if you couldn't solve it, you know, kind of reminds me of the thing with Solomon. And, you know, he comes up with this riddle about, you know, when with the lion and the bees and the honeycomb. And that's another thing. I'm going over some of your heads. Sorry, James. Okay, forget that. Never mind. Anyway, it's just like this puzzle thing. And so some have suggested that that's what this 120 talents was for. This was his payment for the latest batch of riddles that he couldn't solve. Interesting. Verse 15. And this is the reason for the forced labor which King Solomon raised to build the house of the Lord, his own house, the Millo, the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer, or Gezer, and burned it with fire and killed the Canaanites who dwelt in it and given it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. Now, so it talks about some of his building projects, this thing called the Millo. We think it's some kind of a landfill somewhere in and around Jerusalem. And actually people have these different ideas of whereabouts it is. But he builds this thing called the Millo, where he fills in like a valley and then makes it a level spot, a terrace where people, they can build more stuff. He mentioned Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Hazor, we visited that last year. Hazor is up in the far north. And it was one of the major Canaanite cities. And Solomon rebuilds it as one of his cities. Megiddo is just a little further south. It's in the Valley of Jezreel. That's where Armageddon's going to take place. It was another big major Canaanite city in ancient times. And a little further than south, down about even with Jerusalem, is where Gezer is. And so he builds these three cities. He makes them fortress cities in a sense, kind of like guarding. And see, actually, let's see if I can do this. There's actually a road that runs along here. It's called the Way of the City, the Way of the Sea. The Romans called it Via Maris. Isaiah quotes this. I'm winging it here. It's like Isaiah 60, 62. When he talks about there will be a great light will shine. People who dwell in darkness. It will happen along the Way of the Sea. It's a road that runs up the coastline, hangs right at Megiddo, and then comes up around the Sea of Galilee and then heads up north. And it's along the Via Maris is where the Capernaum, Jesus' headquarters, is right up here. Jesus, it's talking about Jesus' ministry. Anyway, these are cities that are along this great main trading route. Hazor. You guys were with us in Hazor. That's right. Daryl and Denise, this is great that you guys showed up tonight. I was just like, okay. Anyway, so part of Hazor, remember all the burned layers that we saw in Hazor? Well, one of the layers would be Solomon's building that he's building along this way. Verse 17, Solomon built Gezer, Lower Beth Horon, Baalat, and Tadmor in the wilderness in the land of Judah. All the storage cities that Solomon had, these would be places for storing food, cities for his chariots and cities for his cavalry and whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. Now mentions, again, we've talked about where Gezer is. gays are kind of off down in the plain near Jerusalem. And near Gezer would be these some of these other cities, Beth Horon and Baalat. Tadmor is a little bit up toward up in modern Syria, way, way up here. In fact, it's sitting on what is now the modern city of Palmyra. Tadmor means palms. And nowadays it's called Palmyra. It's interesting. The word was is that at one point when he's building his kingdom, somebody asked Solomon, have you had enough? And he says, I just want a tad more. What do you think? No? He says no. Okay, sorry. Verse 20, all the people who were left of the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites who were not of the children of Israel, that is, their descendants who were left in the land after them, whom the children of Israel had not been able to destroy completely, from these Solomon raised forced labor, as it is to this day. Now, these are the nations when Joshua came into the land that they were told to conquer, and they did not wipe them out like God had told them to wipe them out. And it's from these people that Solomon raises his, it's a slave labor thing, it's forced labor. And these are the people who will do the hard labor when it comes to build, when it came to building the temple and his palace. Verse 22, but of the children of Israel, Solomon made no forced laborers because they were men of war. And his servants, his officers, his captains, commanders of his chariots and his cavalry. Others were chiefs of the officials who were over Solomon's work, 550 who ruled over the people who did the work. So the Israelites were used for military and leadership positions. Verse 24, but Pharaoh's daughter came up from the city of David to her house, which Solomon had built her. Then he built the millo. Now, three times a year, Solomon offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar, which he had built for the Lord. He burned incense with them on the altar that was before the Lord. So he finished the temple. Three times a year, this would be in keeping with God's commands in Exodus that all men would appear before the Lord three times a year. And they would do this during the three big feasts, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. And so the idea is that that's when Solomon also will bring his offerings to the Lord three times a year. Verse 26. King Solomon also built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Eilat, on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. Then Hiram sent his servants with the fleet, seamen who knew the sea, to work with the servants of Solomon. And they went to Ophir and acquired 420 talents of gold from there and brought it to King Solomon. Ezion, Geber, and Eilat. These are cities in the south, far to the south, down by the Red Sea, Ezion, Geber, and then back up a little further. There's a modern city named Eilat, where Eilat was. And that's the tip of the Red Sea, right here. And so that's kind of the southern port for Israel. They've got stuff there now. And it says he built a fleet of ships and it says Hiram would send his servants with Solomon's servants. Hiram is the king of Tyre. That's the capital of the Phoenician Empire. And the Phoenicians were known for their naval expertise. They were the ones that populated. They were one of the first civilizations that populated the whole Mediterranean. The Phoenician civilization covers the entire circle of the Mediterranean, from the north coast of Africa all the way up, you know, Spain, Italy, all that kind of stuff. So his buddy Hiram was good with boats. He had good sailors with him. And the Israelites, not so much. And so he knows where to find good help. And so he and his buddy, they form a deal and they send their boats out. Says they went to Ophir. Now, we're not exactly sure where Ophir is, except we're pretty sure that it's south somewhere from Eilat. Some people put it on the Arabian Peninsula in the south. Some people put it across the Red Sea on the east coast of Africa. Some people put it all the way over on the east coast of the Arabian Peninsula. And some put it all the way over into India. Those are the suggestions that people make. But the idea is that that's where their boats would go. They would head south to this place called Ophir, which means reducing to ashes. I don't know what that's about. And they brought in, at least on this one trip, 420 talents of gold. That's 16 tons or like $800 million. I wonder if any of the boats sunk and if there's still treasure out there. I don't know. Fascinating stuff. Verse 1 of chapter 10. Now, when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. Sheba. Sheba is in that same area that we were just looking at. If you go south of Eilat, Sheba is in the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. So wherever you put Ophir, when the guys are sailing to Ophir, they're going to get acquainted with this kingdom of Sheba. When the queen of Sheba finds out about this guy named Solomon, she's intrigued. And remember what monarchs do in their free time? They quiz each other. You know, they ask each other questions. And so she shows up to test him with her hard questions. Josephus calls her the queen of Egypt and Ethiopia. And she came to test him with hard questions. Just like we've been seeing, like with Hiram and Solomon. She came, verse 2, to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels that bore spices, very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, I guess she figured she's going to lose a lot of bets or something, huh? I don't know. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. So Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he could not explain to her. Now, I have to tell you, when it comes to Solomon, he's a tricky character to know what to do with. Because there's times where he's like really good, and he's the son of David, for Pete's sake. And you think, son of David, and he answers all her questions. It reminds you of Jesus. It reminds me of Jesus. You know, so parts of Solomon are really good. Parts of him are really screwed up, as we're going to see the end of tonight and into next week. You know, he's got some problems. He's not the perfect son of David. So it's kind of hard to know what to do with Solomon. I mean, he writes one of the bestest love poems in the world, the Song of Solomon. Written to his beloved, one of a thousand. I mean, so what do you do with that? You know, he's a messy guy, kind of like us, huh? We're a bit messy ourselves, aren't we? Verse 4. When the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built. Remember, he spent 13 years building his house. The food on his table. He's blown away with how he eats every day. The seating of his servants, the service of his waiters and their apparel, his cupbearers, and his entryway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. She's like fainted away. Then she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw with my own eyes. And indeed, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity exceed the fame of which I heard. Happy are your men, and happy are these your servants, who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord has loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness. Interesting stuff. She said, I heard about you, but man, when I came and saw this, wow, took her breath away. She heard about the words and she did something. She sought him out. Jesus talks about the Queen of Sheba. The Queen of Sheba. Didn't your grandma used to use that? How did she used to say it? Yeah, how many of you have heard that phrase? Yeah, okay. Who do you think you are, the Queen of Sheba? That's not just a Kansas thing. Outside of Kansas, we've heard that? Okay. I want to call this application lesson thing, I want to call it living proof. When Jesus talked about the Queen of Sheba, he was speaking a rebuke to the Jewish people around him who were listening to him. And they were complaining and griping about him. And he said, the queen of the south will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And indeed, a greater than Solomon is here. That was what Jesus had to say about the Queen of Sheba. She heard about Solomon, but she wanted to find out for herself. And she wasn't going to let anything stop her from finding and hearing this guy. The people in Jesus' day didn't seem so impressed with him. And yet here's Jesus Christ, the son of David, the Son of God. The Queen of Sheba was willing to see what the truth was all about. She would have done, if she was alive in Jesus' day, nothing would have stopped her from seeing Jesus. I want to kind of talk about this as if we were in Solomon's place. How does what people say about us match what we really are? She'd heard about Solomon, and when she found out and got up close to Solomon, it was like even better than she'd heard. What about us? Jesus said, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. I hope that we can kind of be like Solomon, in the sense that there's not only a good word about you, about your character, but that when people get up close, they find out it's the real deal. You know, you're not just a phony who says things, but when people get up close, they find out, oh, he's just a jerk. You know what I'm saying? I know in a sense we are all jerks. I know that. I'm not trying to get beyond that. But to let our works shine in such a way that when people get up close to you, they go, wow, there's something real going on here. I think that's what God wants in our lives. It means we've got to really let God work in our lives. We got to be serious about letting God work in our lives. You know, my friends, sometimes Christians can fall into this trap where we know all the right things to say, but we don't let the truth get inside of us to change how we act. And the hard thing with that is that sometimes it's not easy letting the truth change us, is it? Sometimes it means I got to deal with stuff in my life, and that's not fun. Living the Christian life isn't always fun. Learning to say no to things. Learning the discipline. You know, Pastor Larry was talking about spiritual disciplines, developing habits that cultivate a deeper walk with the Lord. Well, it does. It takes discipline. There's an element of discipline to read your Bible every day. Is that something that only really, really good Christians do? No. Well, it should be something that we all do. Whether it's a paragraph a day, or whether it's, you know, a couple of chapters a day. But it's something we all ought to be a discipline that we do. I mean, there's lots of things that we do in a disciplined way and in an undisciplined way. You know, eating. I like to eat whether I'm disciplined or not. My problem is I have to work at disciplining myself to not eat so much. That's been the hard thing to learn. But I don't have trouble eating every day because I'm aware of my own hunger. Although we could be that way with God's word, with prayer. With prayer. To be so convinced of the value and the power in prayer that it becomes a daily discipline. That there are things, there are some things that are so important to me that I've decided I'm going to ask God for them every day. There's some people that I pray for every day because, frankly, they're way too important to me. And so I pray for them every day. There are things about myself that I pray for every day because I'm learning that actually the growing part goes easier when I'm asking God's help for these things every day. And gang, as we allow him to work, oh, then it might be just like the Queen of Sheba and Solomon. Well, I heard about this, but when I got up and actually saw it and saw what it is to walk with God, wow, this is the real, you're the real deal. Oh, may it be that way with us. May it be that way with us. Kim Beller sent me this email out of the blue. She never sends me email. Maybe she sent it to a million people. Maybe a bunch of you got the email too, so I shouldn't feel like I'm so privileged. But Kimmy sent me this thing, and it just blew me away because it fit this whole thing so perfectly. It says, a few years ago, a group of salesmen went to a regional sales convention in Chicago. They had assured their wives that they would be home in plenty of time for Friday night dinner. In their rush with tickets and briefcases, one of these salesmen inadvertently kicked over a table that held a display of apples in the airport. Apples flew everywhere. Without stopping or looking back, they all managed to reach the plane in time for their nearly missed boarding, all but one. He paused, took a deep breath, got in touch with his feelings, and experienced a twinge of compassion for the girl whose apple cart had been overturned. He told his buddies to go on without him, waved goodbye, told one of them to call his wife when they arrived at their home destination and explain his taking a later flight. When he returned to the terminal where the apples were all over the floor, he did it, and he was glad that he did. The 16-year-old girl was totally blind. She was softly crying, tears running down her cheeks in frustration, and at the same time, helplessly groping for her spilled produce as the crowd swirled around her, no one stopping and no one seemed to care about what was going on. The salesman knelt on the floor with her. He gathered up the apples, put them back on the table, helped her organize the display. As he did, he noticed that many of them had become battered and bruised. These he set aside in another basket. When he had finished, he pulled out his wallet and said to the girl, "Here, please take this $40 for the damage we did. Are you okay?" She nodded through her tears. He continued on with, "I hope we didn't spoil your day too badly." As the salesman started to walk away, the bewildered blind girl called out to him. "Mister," he paused and turned to look back into those blind eyes. She said, "Are you Jesus?" She stopped in mid-stride, and he wondered. He gently went back and said, "No, I am nothing like Jesus. He is good, kind, caring, loving, and would never have bumped into your display in the first place." The girl gently nodded, "I only asked because I prayed for Jesus to help me gather the apples. He sent you to help me, so you are like him. Only he knows who will do his will. Thank you for hearing his call, mister." That's what we're talking about, living proof. That people would see something in us. That I think that comes from us learning to walk and obey and learning to do the things. So that we're not just talk. Oh, we heard about you. No, but when they hear about you and then they get to know you. And they get up close and they go, yeah, hey, you know what? You're the real deal. Yeah. That's what I want. That's what I want in my life. Verse 10. Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold. That's a mess. That's a huge bunch. Spices in great quantity. Precious stones. There never again came such abundance of spices as the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Lots of spices. So when they had meatballs that night, he said, Mamma mia, that's a spicy meatball. No, maybe not. Verse 11. Also the ships of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought great quantities of almug wood. I heard that that might be sandalwood. And precious stones from Ophir. And the king made steps of the almug wood for the house of the Lord and for the king's house. Also harps and stringed instruments for the singers. There never again came such almug wood, nor has the like been seen to this day. Now King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba all she desired, whatever she asked, besides what Solomon had given her according to the royal generosity. So she turned and went to her own country, she and her servants. And it says, he gave the queen of Sheba all that she desired. Now here's where the story of Solomon goes a little. This is a tradition. May not be so. This is an Ethiopian tradition. According to Ethiopian tradition, when the Queen of Sheba left, she had one last present from Solomon. She was pregnant. Until 1974, Ethiopia had been ruled for several thousand years by a monarchy that claimed to be descended from King Solomon. They claimed that when Queen Sheba came home from Jerusalem visiting Solomon, she was pregnant. And they claimed that she was their queen. Ethiopia was a monarchy until 1974, the last ruling emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie. He was overthrown in 1974. He died in 1975 at the age of 83. Whether it's real or not, that's interesting, an interesting tradition. Of course, with all of his thousand other wives, who knows, there might be something to this. We don't know. Just an interesting thing, just so that when you come across this, you won't go, what? Who knows? Maybe, maybe not. Chapter 10, verse 14. The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. 666, an ominous sounding amount, wouldn't you say so? Ominous sounding, what am I going to make of it? I'm not going to make anything of it. Let's move on. Verse 15. Besides that, from the traveling merchants, from the income of traders, from all the kings of Arabia, and from the governors of the country. And King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold. 3 minas of gold went in each of these shields. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. So some of them are little round things. Some of them are big, tall things. These shields of gold. I've always looked at these shields of gold as being kind of symbolic of the height of Solomon's reign. This is the peak of Solomon's reign. Why do I look at it this way? Because when his son Rehoboam becomes king, things start going downhill. And one of the things that will change will be the shields that will be stored in the house of Lebanon, because they will no longer be shields of gold, but those will have been taken, and now they're going to be replaced with shields of bronze. And you'll see that the whole kingdom starts to take a slide. We have the devaluation of the shekel, something like that. So verse 18, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. I got a picture that somebody painted of it. The throne had 6 steps, and the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the seat, the place of the seat. 2 lions stood beside the armrest. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the 6 steps. Nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. So he makes this this throne out of ivory. It's kind of hard to see. It's kind of dark, isn't it? But and he overlays this thing with gold. There's lion because he's, you know, that's a Judah thing, lion of the tribe of Judah kind of thing. An amazing display of wealth. Verse 21, all King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold. And all the vessels of the house of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. Somebody gives him a silver cup. That goes in the kitchen. That's part of the Dixie cups are all silver, you know. What do you mean? We'd throw this stuff out. You know, Solomon, silver's nothing, you know. For the king had merchant ships. How about that for, I mean, you think about that. I mean, everything's gold. Why? Because it's, you know, it's, we got enough. You know, we got enough, we can do this. The king had merchant ships at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Verse 22, once every 3 years, the merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys. New King James says merchant ships. Old King James says ships of Tarshish. And it may be that maybe it is about merchant ships, but Tarshish is also the name of what we believe is the area around Spain, possibly even Great Britain. That's the place that Jonah runs to when he's trying to run from the Lord. It's kind of like the far end of the world. So anyway, he's got these ships, and they bring gold, silver, and ivory. We're talking about that. And apes and monkeys. What are the apes and monkeys about? I think this is about entertainment. Apes and monkeys. It's like he had the biggest big screen TV of everybody. You know, he's got apes and monkeys, and every day he's got all new entertainment. The guy's got everything. This is even 3D HD TV because, you know, with the monkeys and the apes and stuff like that. Verse 23. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. Years ago, I noticed that Pastor Chuck made a comment about this. They thought it was fascinating that it's not that he's known for wisdom and riches, but riches and wisdom. And there might be something telling to that, the fact that his riches are taking center stage. He's going to write at the end of his life in Ecclesiastes. He's going to say this. This is Solomon writing. Those who love money will never have enough. How does he know that?
Well, you know those, you know.
How meaningless to think that wealth brings true happiness. Now, verse 11. The more you have, the more people come to help you spend it. So what good is wealth? Except perhaps to watch it slip through your fingers. People who work hard sleep well, whether they eat little or much, but the rich seldom get a good night's sleep. Okay, true question. This is one of those questions that I expect everybody to raise your hand on. How many of you have ever got yourself thinking, if I only had more money? Anybody else think? You never thought that? You never thought that, girl? You never thought me? It's so long ago, you can't remember. I love it. I love it. Greed is never satisfied. You can never get enough. And so be careful of thinking that more money is the answer to your problem. Be careful. Some of the happiest people I know are not the wealthiest. Verse 24. Now all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Each man brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, and mules at a set rate year by year. So people are like so impressed. They're bringing him gifts. And in a way, I just have to point this out. Some people will mention this, so that's why I want to point this out. Some people look at this as a picture of what life will be like when Jesus comes back and rules and reigns during the millennium. In Zechariah says, "And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." You kind of see a picture of this happening in Solomon's day, where people from all over the world are coming up to honor the king, to honor Solomon. And so in a sense, you just have to be careful with the Solomon thing. You know, because he's got the good, he's got the bad, you know. So you're going to have to sort your way through this. But in a way, he is a faint picture of what Jesus will be like. Because the whole world, whatever's left at the end of the tribulation, they'll be coming to honor the king. Just like this. Verse 26. "And Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities with the king at Jerusalem." 12,000 horsemen. This is the quote I was thinking I was going to have up. This is from Josephus. He writes this. He writes about the horsemen. This is a fascinating thing. He says this: "Their riders also were a further ornament to them, being in the first place young men in the most delightful flower of their age, and being eminent for their largeness, and far taller than other men." So he picked the basketball team to be his horse riders. "They had also very long heads of hair hanging down, and were clothed in garments of Tyrian purple. They had also dust of gold every day sprinkled on their hair, so that their heads sparkled with the reflection of the sunbeams from the gold." That's amazing. I was like, whoa. I mean, they had enough gold. They had enough gold, you know. A little short on change here. Can I just sprinkle my beard out on you, you know? Just... Again, this is Josephus. You don't want to make too much of this, but if that's true, oh my gosh, this is the height of the kingdom. Height of the kingdom. Verse 27. "The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones." So they would like skip silver across the pond. Not skip stones. They would skip, "They would break the windows of the houses with silverware." The bad kids, you know. Okay. "He made cedar trees as abundant as the sycamores, which were in the lowland. Also, Solomon had horses imported from Egypt and Keva. The king's merchants bought them in Keva at the current price." Now, a chariot that was imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver, and a horse 150, and thus, through their agents, they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. So he becomes like a used horse salesman. They become, you know, they're horse traders. Prosperity's danger. The older Solomon gets, the wealthier he gets, and frankly, the more he will begin to slip. So here's where we see the danger. This doesn't mean that every wealthy person is bad or is going bad. Doesn't have to be that way at all. Does not have to be that way at all. But Solomon is a warning. Paul wrote, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It can take you down the wrong roads, make you do the wrong things. God gave Moses some instructions for kings. We've mentioned this before. And he gives him three things to worry about. Deuteronomy 17, talking about kings. This was written 400, 500 years before there were a king. It says, "But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself." So he's told not to multiply three things. What were the three things? Horses, wives, and silver and gold. And right here, we've seen he's got two of them. He's doing the horse thing, and he's doing the silver and gold thing. Next week, in the next, as we start the next chapter, you'll see the wives. And these things will lead him away from God. It's tough stuff. Tough stuff. It doesn't have to be that way. When Paul wrote the warning to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, later on in the chapter, he says, but I'll tell you what, you tell the people that are wealthy to be rich in good deeds. You can, you don't have to go the wrong way. So with that, we're done. And I'm actually done early for once. Whew, finally. Let's stand and pray. Father, I thank you for my friends here. And Lord, would you encourage us and challenge us, Lord, in your ways. Lord, help us to pay attention to the issues of our heart, to the things that entice us in the wrong direction. And Lord, may your work continue in our lives. We want it to be a real work. We want people to get up close and see how good you are. May we have a little bit of what they said at this point about Solomon. That they, like Sheba said, that she'd heard about it and now she saw it. Lord, may it be that way in our lives. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.